Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I am your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today. For this week's episode, I am joined by two different guests, Prash Pusponatan and Agnieszka Sekula from Enosis Therapeutics, a company based in Australia that is working to develop VR programs and applications for use in psychedelic therapy to help create consistent environments for those undergoing the therapeutic process. We had a great conversation the other week, and I'll get that to you in just a couple moments. But first, let's get to some announcements. I would like to thank Jen, who has signed on as a new patron over at my Patreon page. It's a great way to support this podcast, which has now been running for almost 15 full years. Thank you very much to Jen for signing up. This is the first new patron I've had over the past month, and really appreciate all the support that I get from everybody over at Patreon. And also enjoy interacting with those who are paying for levels that get a monthly check-in or consult with me. And of course, I hear back from my patrons that they enjoy the gifts that they receive with my art on it as thank yous for their membership. If you'd like to sign up as a supporter over at Patreon, you can just go to my personal webpage at martinball.net and use the Patreon link at the top right of my page, or you can go to patreon.com/martinwball. And of course, if you'd like to make a PayPal donation in support of this podcast, you can also do that at my webpage, martinball.net. Just use the PayPal link at the top right of the page. And it is due to supporters that keep this podcast running and going strong. So thank you very much for your support. If you've supported in the past or intend to support in the future, and of course, again, a special thank you to everybody who has their monthly support over there at Patreon. Really means a great deal to me, and really appreciate it. Let's see, coming up on the podcast, I think I mentioned before that I have author Cliff Dunning and his book Cannabis and Sexual Ecstasy for Men is going to be coming up. We've also got Bernardo, who was a Marine, a Benedictine monk, and a 5-MeO-DMT facilitator currently. And let's see, I have Heather, Heather Wickman, who does work with horses and psychedelic therapy. So, of course, many more great things coming up on the podcast for the remainder of the year here with intermittent selections from the Entheological Paradigm 2021 edition, of course. One last announcement that I'd just like to share with you guys is that I've got a little new music out there that is available for your listening pleasure. You know, several weeks ago, a group in the Middle East organized a private talk with me, and it was recorded on Zoom, and the organizer sent me back a selection of my talk where I was invited to share my story of my first full experience with 5-MeO-DMT. And I felt that there was a nice rhythm to the talk that I gave and thought, well, I'll put this to music. So I went ahead and I put it to music, and it actually worked out really well. So it's over at my Bandcamp page. The track is The Pure Energy of Unconditional Love, which is a line that came from my talk. And I've got two different versions up there. I've got the talk version, and then I made another instrumental mix. And actually, I think I'll put the new instrumental mix at the end of the interview today for you to enjoy. But if you want to grab it, it's over there at martinball.bandcamp.com. Of course, I am always available for 30, 60, and 90-minute consultations to help you prepare for, to integrate, and just generally talk about your work with psychedelics and entheogens. I specialize in 5-MeO-DMT, but of course, I'm not limited to that. For more information, go over to nondualentheogenicintegration.com. It, of course, is all done from a non-dual perspective to help you understand you. Okay, that's it for announcements today. Let's go ahead and get into the conversation. Once again, this is Prash and Agnieszka from EnosisTherapeutics.com if you want to check them out online. And I believe that they are currently now in the United States looking for people to help develop their programs and apply them to their therapeutic settings. So let's get into our conversation. They joined me from two different locations. There are slight delays in the audio because, you know, it was a three-way conversation with people in several different places. But other than that, I think it's all good to go. So enjoy. you know, just thinking about how I've been doing this podcast for almost 15 years now. And over the course of those 15 years, that the subject matter has changed rather dramatically for people that I'm having on for interviews here on the podcast. And so this is one of these interesting firsts, because it's a reflection of kind of where we are at culturally and socially versus where we were when I first started this podcast. But our topic today is about Enosis Therapeutics, and this is a company that both Agnieszka and Prash are developing to tailor VR, virtual reality experiences, for psychedelic therapeutic usage. And so this is a brand new topic on the podcast. And so I was very interested when I got an email message saying, hey, would you like to have these two on to talk about this? Because it's something very, very new and very fresh. So very interested to dive into this topic today with both of you guys. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Martin.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, so just to start, especially since we've got two of you here, I would like to invite both of you to just give a little bit of an introduction to yourself and kind of what your area within this space is, and any part of your background that you would like to share. And I'm just going to go ahead and, okay, well, Agnieszka says, Prash, go first. I was going to say, I'm going to go with Agnieszka because you're on the top of my screen, but we'll go with Prash. We'll start at the bottom and we'll work our way up to the top. So Prash, go ahead and introduce yourself. And yes, please correct me if I've completely mispronounced your name at all.
No, you've done relatively well. It gets butchered far worse on the regular. So my name is Prash. I'm a medical doctor who did psychiatry training purely for the purpose of working with psychedelics. I started off after finishing medical school as a surgical trainee, and it was discovering psychedelics and diving down that rabbit hole that led me to cease to be that interested in the body and want to operate on the mind instead. And over the course of the last 8-9 years, I have been one of the more outspoken advocates for psychedelic therapy in Australia, which, just considering it was before it all became fashionable the last couple of years, was a lot of pushing a load uphill for a long while. And it's nice to see some validation in terms of where the industry has come so far. And in terms of Enosis, I am distinctly the clinical and psychotherapeutic component of the team. And I'll leave the brainchild to introduce herself.
Yeah, well, let me just actually ask you a quick follow-up question, Prash, before we move on to Agnieszka. Just speaking about Australia, I'm wondering if you could give us just a little bit of a picture of what the psychedelic psychotherapeutic landscape is looking like these days in Australia. You know, here in the United States, like I was saying back when I started this podcast 15 years ago, that there was no such thing as psychedelic psychotherapy other than underground practitioners. And it was not something that was really discussed openly culturally. And as you say, within the past few years, it's really come above board. There are now universities offering training programs for people to get certificates and degrees in psychedelic psychotherapy. And here in Oregon, where I live, next year, we are supposed to be starting a psilocybin-assisted therapy program statewide, though there's currently some issues with the implementation of the program. But it's come a long way in that time period. But I'm just wondering if you could maybe give us a snapshot of how things have been in Australia itself in terms of the above-ground, legitimate psychotherapeutic space in using psychedelics.
Sure. I mean, Australia has been slow on the draw, as it sometimes tends to be. There's been a lot of buzz in the last couple of years in the research space. We've got, at the moment, we've had one trial, which is an end-of-life anxiety with psilocybin trial, which has been well underway for about a year and a half, almost 2 years. There's a general anxiety and psilocybin trial that's just gotten off the ground. So I'd say at this point, there are probably only about two trials that are actually running. There are at least another three trials, including an MDMA PTSD trial, a psilocybin for treatment resistant depression trial, and a psilocybin for alcohol addiction trial that are being planned and sort of close to recruiting. What's particularly interesting is that the research community, the therapeutic community, has been pushing at this door for a few years now, and obviously someone's listening. The Australian government announced a Medical Research Futures Fund, which is a $15 million fund dedicated to psychedelic research, with the first lot of that fund that was doled out last year, which is very encouraging. So it does open the door to a considerable amount of research. Having said that, the doorway to actual therapeutics in terms of patients being able to access this the way they would access this through your doctor is probably a few years away. And I mean, I do think that's probably sensible. Places like Oregon, for example, have had many years of a sort of a culture of this emerging, whereas I think we need a bit of time for that culture to properly emerge and for enough therapists to be trained within the research settings so that we can safely roll it out and implement it in therapeutics.
Okay, great. Thank you. So let's go ahead and turn to Agnieszka, and please introduce yourself and your role within Enosis and how you got into this field.
Hi. So good job at pronouncing my name first time around. It doesn't usually end up this well, so well done. So my background is in biomedical science and psychology. And I've been using virtual reality in a range of medical applications for almost a decade before I started to look at it as a more therapeutic tool and got interested in its properties that are relevant to therapy. And this was around the time when I also discovered psychedelic research and realized how much potential does psychedelic psychotherapy bring to mental health, and how we could potentially use it to transform how we approach mental health, how we approach mental well-being in general. And so both of those tools seemed incredibly interesting to me from that perspective. And it was a few years ago when I met Prash and we started to talk more deeply about psychedelics and altered states of consciousness and the potential in therapy, that it clicked for me that both of those methods have a huge potential in addressing mental health problems, but in slightly different ways, in ways that seemed very synergistic to me. And this is when I reached out to Prash and we started to kind of play around with that idea of how to use virtual reality to address certain limitations that we've recognized within the psychedelic psychotherapy approach. And how to bridge some of the gaps that patients were starting to notice in the clinical trials that emerged during that time, basically to maximize the total benefits that patients could receive from those therapies if they were combined. So it started as a research project. It started actually as my PhD research to look into how those synergistic properties can be beneficial to one another, how those mechanisms could be used to sort of benefit each other, and how to apply this in specific protocols for therapy. And then we recognized the benefit that this could bring to the industry, and predominantly because of the pandemic and because of research being really halted due to the pandemic, we decided to start a company. We wanted to push for this, and academia was unfortunately really behind during that time. So Enosis really was a bit of a child of the pandemic. And then we realized that there's actually big benefit to running a company in this space and to being able to connect with other professionals, connect with clinicians, connect with therapists through the company, and sort of leverage those resources to make sure that we make the most of both worlds. So at the moment, we are pursuing both research and sort of our commercial interests at the same time. In a way, researching what are the best approaches of using VR and psychedelics together, and then immediately translating that into development of VR, which is something that we do in-house at Enosis.
Great. Well, we're going to talk definitely about all of that. And I will say, when the proposal was first made, that came in through email about interviewing you guys and the use of VR with psychedelic therapy, that I was definitely very interested. Like, wow, I wonder what the application is, other than that VR is cool and you can see neat stuff, and psychedelic therapy, it's cool, you can see neat stuff. And so it actually wasn't until today, just in preparation for our interview, that I went and I took a look at the website, and the link will be in the notes to the podcast, but it's Enosis Therapeutics. It's E-N-O-S-I-S therapeutics.com. And that's where any listeners can go to learn more about Enosis. And then also, you guys have put out an academic paper kind of discussing this from a very academic perspective, kind of looking at all the research and all the different issues about sort of the stages of psychedelic psychotherapeutic processes, and where different kinds of interventions might be used, and transitions from one state to the next, and how VR could apply in these different states. So you guys definitely have fairly clear ideas of where and how VR fits in. So maybe let's go ahead and we can turn the conversation now into that. First, maybe we should discuss just a little bit about what kind of VR we're talking about, because I'm sure many people are thinking of like video games and things like that, where you put on your VR headset and you're using your little paddles or whatever. And then the specific applications for these, the different phases or different issues that you guys have identified as it being potentially beneficial within the therapeutic context. And also some of the, maybe some of the potential distractions that it might cause, because those are also listed in the paper that you guys have produced as well. So we can start anywhere within there, but maybe just first a little bit about the VR itself.
Yeah, that's a very broad question, and we could be speaking about this for the next few hours. But just broadly, you're right to notice that there is a lot of different uses of VR. VR did become a little bit of a catchphrase for anything that is sort of within this immersive environment, but it's such diverse applications that you can't really, you know, put a sort of parallel sign between all of them. It's a very different application when you think about killing zombies in VR versus using a meditative environment, right, to improve well-being. And what is interesting, really, is that even though VR is very well known for within the gaming industry or education industry, these are the two sort of major uses or major applications that VR is finding itself in. Its origins are actually mostly related to exploring its sort of therapeutic potential, to exploring its capacity to induce an altered state of consciousness or to explore the subconscious. VR was developed with exploring the horizons of the subconscious mind. This was the phrase that was used as an inspiration for development of VR. It was supposed to be this alternate reality where we can explore who we really are. But that was quite quickly forgotten because of all the very attractive industry applications within the gaming industry. And so we are only just now starting to go back to that and starting to understand what those initial ideas behind creating VR were, and why they were right in a lot of ways. And we're only just looking into exploring how those immersive properties of VR can actually induce very powerful altered states. This research only just began, and we are seeing some very promising results. And this is something that we are predominantly interested in. So just to sort of contrast this with some of the VR ideas that are floating around in relation to psychedelics, which often use sort of try to replicate the visuals, for example, of the psychedelic experience using different fractals or hallucination-like visuals. Or their approach is that focus on creating a container for the dosing session, which is either a beautiful room or just simple nature immersion model. So this is basically just to provide an ideal space where someone can relax and dive deeper into their trip. And these are predominantly the kind of approaches that are being utilized. And most of the VR companies that work in this space are focusing on preparation or the beginning of or shortly before the dosing session, basically just to ease the mind and to help the patient prepare and relax before the dosing trip. In our case, we are looking at maximizing the potential of the altered state of consciousness by applying VR from preparation through dosing and throughout the entire integration process. So what we're trying to do is to make sure that those emotional experiential moments in therapy that psychedelics are so good at inducing are also promoted throughout all the other phases of treatment, which at the moment are predominantly based on talk therapy, which is much more cognitively heavy, analytical, and contrast that emotional experiential approach that is explored during the dosing session. So what we're trying to do is to create a framework using this unique immersive environment around the dosing session so that that experience, that psychedelic experience can be carried on for as long as possible. And patients can have access to sort of return to that experience without repeated dosing for as long as they can. And so we create those immersive environments that support going into the trip, prepare patients for going into the trip by building their intentions for their psychedelic experience. They create their intentions within the VR environment. They construct the totems that are physical representations of that intention. And then they bring that intention with them into the dosing session. So at the beginning of the dosing session, they revisit their intentions. They can play around with them a little bit in the VR environment, and they basically take them with them on that journey, on that psychedelic journey ahead. And then after the psychedelic experience, they come back to their model that they started to create in a preparation session, and they use that space to express the insights that came to them during the psychedelic experience. So basically, the way VR works, it becomes more of a multisensory canvas onto which patients can project anything that they think or feel or experience, rather than us providing a finished model that is somehow projected onto the user. So it's very much about this active engagement of the patient building their own healing trajectory that is constructed from all those little expressions of their thoughts or insights or emotions that came to them during the psychedelic experience. And then the integration process is based on further diving into and exploring those insights and building a mind map of your psychedelic experience so that you can have something that is very tangible and sort of physically expresses what has been happening in your mind and your heart. And so you can have that tangible model that you can keep returning to, not just during the integration process, but also after the integration process concludes in form of self-practice for as long as you want. So this is basically how we're envisioning using VR in psychedelic treatment. And this is something that we are sort of pioneering in this field, and we're just launching our Anchoring VR platform for clinics to use in their practice.
Great. Well, there's definitely a lot in there that I want to return to and talk more about in detail. As I was listening to your response there, Agnieszka, it occurred to me that maybe what we should do is actually back up a moment, and maybe this would be a question for Prash, of kind of addressing the standard model, if we're even at that point, but kind of where we are in terms of when we're talking about psychedelic psychotherapy as done in a professional setting, what are the different phases of the experience of how it is modeled and how it is dealt with within that particular framework and setting? Because there are particular terms that are used that, Agnieszka, that you were mentioning there. So
sure.
Maybe if we could just back up a moment to kind of talk about that and then go back to how VR is used within these different stages and what the applications are, as Agnieszka was just describing there.
Absolutely. Psychedelic therapy in probably in its most optimal form in the way it exists today consists of anywhere from about 2 to 3 sessions of preparation, and those sessions encompass assessment for suitability, preparation for the psychedelic experience, and crucially, setting of intention to take with you into the psychedelic experience. And then there's the dosing session, which can last anywhere from 6 to 10 hours, depending on the actual substance that is utilized. And that is the only session in the psychedelic therapy process where a psychedelic actually is used. That's where the magic happens. But where the magic is actually sustained and where it's turned into actual real-life functional psychobehavioral outcomes is in integration. And integration is weekly sessions of psychotherapy that happen in the weeks that follow on from the dosing session. It's usually anywhere from 4 to, if you're in a really well-funded clinical trial, then maybe you get somewhere between closer to 8 to 10, but it's generally somewhere around between 4 and 6 sessions. And they consist of, weekly psychotherapy that follow a range of different psychotherapeutic modalities or models, but with the main function is to take the insights and learnings that emerge from the psychedelic experience and translate them into the way you live and the way you think and the way you are going forward. So that's the way the model exists today. There is actually a relatively set model. This is the way it tends to occur in general. And it's a point that Agnieszka makes often, which is that this model has been tested many times in research trials, but that it's never been tested against, in that we've sort of accepted this over many years. I mean, this model hasn't really changed since the 50s and 60s. And there has been very little impetus to actually challenge this and try a completely different means of addressing this therapeutic modality. And in a lot of ways, what we are proposing is a challenge to that status quo of the way psychedelic therapy is conducted. And it is challenging that by putting the focus very much on the altered state experience and the insights that emerge from there, with perhaps less of a reliance on cognitive talk therapy and increasing the reliance on the emotional embodied experience that is the psychedelic experience. I hope that gives some context.
Yeah, that's a very interesting way of putting it. Excuse me. This idea of more focusing on the altered states of consciousness, the emotional resonance, the bodily sensations, and not necessarily the cognitive insights or the talk therapy side. So a lot of reading through the paper and looking through the website, that it seems like a lot of the application of the virtual reality is about creating spaces in virtual reality. Excuse me, just got a little something going on in my throat here, but creating spaces within virtual reality that are calming, that draw you in, and that provide kind of a consistent environment, a consistent stimulus, but that is not too psychedelic. This is something that Agnieszka mentioned with virtual reality, that some people have used it to create sort of a replication of the psychedelic state, but that doesn't seem to be the intention here. It's more of creating more of a neutral environment, but it is kind of surreal. It is inviting. Like I was looking through the little video and I was thinking of like some video games that I've played that are, not shoot 'em up video games, but are more of explore this environment kind of video games that has interesting music and nature sounds. And so kind of augmenting these aspects of the alteration of consciousness that comes with psychedelics and using that to really help propel someone into, as it's discussed within the paper, that it really seems to be the mystical experience within the psychedelic experience that seems to have the most therapeutic potential and value for people. So that a lot of the VR application seems designed around helping people surrender into those states and helping them navigate and process them afterwards through the more interactive aspects that Agnieszka was talking about. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah, I think that's what that
spot
is.
On.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very right. And I like how quickly you got on with that. And I'll just add that the important aspect of it is that active engagement of the patient. And as you say, that providing that environment, which is very consistent and has the capacity to evoke more emotional and embodied aspects of treatment, is critical for this to work. But it's something about engagement of the patient who makes the decisions within the VR and who's taking on the leading role in treatment that we see as very empowering. And we see that patients respond very well to being able to create that world for themselves. Because if you think, to contrast with that, if you think about any other form of therapy, the patient is usually visiting the therapist's space, either the clinic or therapist office. So the patient is always the guest in someone else's space. Mm-hmm. That does, in certain way, no matter how much we try, it does in certain way create a sense of hierarchy because you're visiting someone else's space. And with VR, that space belongs to them. It is the patient who's building and constructing their own world. And the way we are setting up our VR scenarios is that the patient can invite the therapist into their VR space, but they don't have to. So it is up to the patient to decide who's welcome in their space. It is up to the patient to decide how that world looks like. And they're in full control over everything that they're creating and they're doing within that space. And that sense of empowerment is also critical for us to enable patients to be more in control over their own healing and have that sense of self-efficacy and fulfillment as they go through it.
So I think that's a very interesting distinction that you just made there about how going into the therapist space and like reading through the paper about how many of these spaces are kind of being designed now as sort of like a comfortable sort of living room kind of space, maybe some sacred art or imagery and flowers or mandalas or plants, things like that. But that within the paper, you guys mentioned that the objects within the room might not have the same meaning or same reference for the patient as it does for the therapist. And so that there can be sort of this disjunction between the intention of creating a space that looks in a certain way and is inviting, but it still might be foreign to the patient, him or herself or themselves. And through the creation of kind of a personalized VR space, that it's allowing the patient to make it more their own space without having to rearrange the office or rearrange the therapeutic setting. And also, I think you guys mentioned that in a sense, they could take it home with them. They can use that same VR space for their own self-exploration and integration work that might come even before the dosing session or after the dosing session. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So one of the big aspects that we are looking at is that sense of permanence. That's again something that emerged from the more recent clinical trials that have showed great success of psychedelics addressing a lot of the indications that they have been used for. But they also highlighted some of the main limitations of the current approach. And one of those limitations has been that lack of sense of permanence in treatment. As Pash mentioned, unfortunately, most of the integration sessions last between 4, 6, maximum 8 or 10 weeks. And that's as much as that might be enough to dive a little bit into what that experience was and what it felt like and what actions to take to keep that integration process going. It's not enough for a patient to feel that sense of security and permanence in treatment that they can keep returning to. And that has been raised as a problem by some patients. In order to have that sense of both cohesion throughout treatment, but also to be able to have that that concept of this will keep going for as long as I need it right from the onset of therapy. If you have that deadline of I only have 6 weeks to process this and the experience seems so vast and so almost improbable, It's a very difficult concept to come to terms with, that you only have this limited time. What we can do with VR is provide that sense of permanence, first by using VR in every single session, that kind of create that unifying thread throughout the entire psychotherapeutic process, but also to ensure patients that they can take this model home with them whenever they're finished with the formal integration process, and continue going through that by themselves at their own pace for as long as they need. So the therapist sets certain guidelines, offers certain concepts and ideas for how to keep going with that self-integration process. And the patient can keep returning to that VR scenario and can keep revisiting it, rebuilding it, and continue to have access to all the raw insights that they created for themselves during the dosing session, to all the advice that the therapist has given to them in this very, very immersive physical environment that keeps reminding them of what that therapy process was like. So it keeps them connected both to the psychedelic experience, and it keeps them connected to the process they've been through with the therapist during the integration phase.
Yeah, and it's all very immersive in that it comes with visual aspects, it comes with sounds, potentially also with music. I certainly know that music is a common adjunct to all kinds of psychedelic sessions, but from shamanic to ritual and ceremonial to also therapeutic. And many people comment on how if they hear a piece of music or a song that was used within their psychedelic session anytime afterwards, that it can recall those states, it can recall those emotions and those energies and those insights. But here you guys are offering an even more immersive and sort of total environment that is transportable, that maybe you're having your psychedelic therapy session in a doctor's office in Perth or wherever you may be, but you're actually in this immersive VR environment, and then you get to take that home with you and you get to revisit it and work with it in that way. And also just noticing from what you guys have here that at Prash, as you were mentioning, that there's the preparation sessions, which happen prior to the dosing session. Then there's the dose session where the client actually takes the psychedelic and has their psychedelic experience. And then there are talk therapy integration sessions that happen afterwards. And it seems like you guys are proposing that the VR can be used for all these different stages. And then also within the dosing session itself, there are then discrete segments of that, of sort of the onset phase, the peak phase, and then the post-peak phase, where there might be different applications for VR. So maybe we can talk about these different aspects. And then also, I really do want to get into some of the more interactive aspects that Agnieszka is mentioning, where you can actually interact with the VR and create certain totems and certain mind maps and these more tangible models that we could interact with in these spaces. So that's a broad category of topics, so we can start wherever you guys like.
Sure, yeah, that is broad. One key point I'll maybe start off with if I'm talking about the different scenarios and how we can use them, is that I think it's crucial to understand, and this is a common misconception about VR, where there's a focus on the aesthetic. I think it's important to understand, certainly in our approach, that the aesthetic is almost the least important part of the VR. The aesthetic is almost, you can think of it as a skin. Rather, it's the functions that we can inbuild into the VR. That is what is really so powerful. You know, a race car is a good race car because of its gearbox and its engine and what the output it produces, not because of the color of its paint. And that's how we need to think about VR. And we have designed a number of different scenarios to be used at a number of different points in the journey. One purpose of this is to provide a sense of continuity and cohesion throughout the entire psychedelic therapy process. So from preparation to dosing to integration, that there's a continuous thread that connects them such that they don't exist in silos individually. And even beyond that, in terms of self-practice and self-integration at home. So it doesn't exist in another silo where the psychedelic therapy process has been left behind. But this continues to be a thread that extends the therapy session into self-practice. We do use a VR scenario sort of at the start of every session. It's a specifically designed scenario that's meant to be relaxing, calming, meditative in a way as a means of grounding someone into that session. That isn't too different with the way we work with, for example, breath work sometimes in psychedelic therapy sessions now, and it serves a similar purpose. Another really important VR function that we utilize is this idea of using VR as a means of allowing an individual to surrender into the altered state experience that is to come. We recognize that period when just before you've taken the psychedelic substance, or particularly after the patient has been dosed and is sort of preparing for the come on of the experience, can be a really anxiety provoking step, even for experience users. That can be quite anxiety provoking. One would almost say, particularly for experience users, there is this sense of, you know, knowing what could come, right?
Right, right.
So, but particularly for the psychedelically naive, it can be enormously anxiety provoking because there's so much they may have read, and then so there's a lot of preloading going into it, and that anxiety is an internal dialogue, or the monkey mind, if you want to call it something else. And a particularly designed, highly immersive VR scenario that is able to fully involve the cognitive faculties of the individual and lead them on a sort of a journey means it buffers the internal dialogue. And in that way, doesn't leave room in a way for that internal dialogue to take an individual down the unfortunate rabbit holes that we call anxiety, and in that way modulates that journey and the pathway into the dosing experience. So that's another example of how we utilize VR. We've already talked about at considerable length about the anchoring model, which is probably the mainstay of what we use. But yeah, I hope that gives a bit of a snapshot of the different methodologies in which we can use virtual reality. There are different scenarios that we've designed for each of these. They need to be quite specific. We've researched them. There's an enormous amount of feedback and feedback loop process, design process that's gone into designing these, testing them out in case studies. And that's how we've gotten to this point. But we're going to keep developing.
Is there anything you wanted to add to that, Agnieszka?
I can sort of elaborate on the second part of your question, which was about the interactive component.
Sure.
So we've developed our anchoring model, as Prash mentioned, in collaboration with a lot of clinicians and therapists, and got plenty of feedback from people who work in this field extensively. And so we developed the anchoring model for the purpose of integration based on a sort of mix of different therapeutic frameworks that are currently most commonly used in psychedelic treatment. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them. The two of the most common ones are acceptance commitment therapy and internal family systems. And there are others, obviously, but there is an overlap between all of them in terms of identifying different groups or themes that are sort of underlying the insights that emerge from the psychedelic experience. So it's about exploration of those thoughts or insights and how they sort of connect with one another, how they connect with broader themes in one's life, how they might relate to different representations of the self. So we all have different selves, whether it's a child self or a protector self, and how they connect to different parts of ourselves within us? How do we work within sort of our own system with different components of ourselves, and how we interact with different components of ourselves? This is kind of sort of the therapeutic approach that a lot of therapists are using in psychedelic treatment. And this is something that was the initial idea that inspired how we constructed our model. And so the way the interaction sort of occurs in anchoring VR is through working with your insights and exploring your insights by developing different different groups and themes around those insights. And so you can create a group for yourself within the VR, and you can put any insight that you've collected during your dosing session and put it into the group and connect groups with groups and basically create a sort of a palace, as we call it, of those different insights and emotions that emerged during your experience. And you construct this, you build this world of different groups and themes to represent that the mind map that I spoke of before. And that's how the sort of the basic interaction occurs within the VR. So you're building this mind map around yourself. And then as you dive deeper into the integration process, you can use a lot of other symbolic actions to represent how you think about those, either those individual insights or the groups of insights that you've created for yourself. For example, if there is an insight that you believe you need to nourish, let's say a connection with a family member that you've maybe forgotten about, and you need to tend to it, to let it grow, you can use that insight and physically plant it in front of you. And with every action that you take towards nourishing that insight in between the integration sessions, for example, you called that person or you wrote to that person or you've done something nice to them, you can create water within the VR environment and water that plant that you've planted for yourself, and that plant will grow in front of you to show you how that how many actions you've taken in order to nourish that insight. So that's one of the sort of symbolic actions that can be created within the VR. There are other symbolic actions that we enable, like, for example, if there are insights that no longer serve you, you can burn them in the bonfire. If there are insights that seem very critical in your life and you would like to have them as something that guides you, for example, some sort of value that you would like to use as a guidance in your life, you can send it up to the sky as the northern star. So there's a whole range of different symbolic actions that you can take within VR that feel very very tangible and very realistic in terms of taking different actions to make sure that you keep expanding and exploring those insights in a way that translates directly to your life.
So I believe that here we're mostly speaking about the anchoring VR, and this sounds like is sort of the most interactive component for the patient, and this is where they're going to be continuing to return into the space, interacting with it, designing it according to their own insights and their own symbolic preferences, and that this is a place that they can keep coming back to kind of keep revisiting their psychotherapeutic process. And we also have a couple other things that are mentioned on the website that you guys are developing of the, so the anchoring VR, the little tag for that is a multi-sensory memory library, kind of this mind map that you guys have been talking about. Then we have surrender VR, which is an awe-invoking scenario. Then there's rescue VR, a digital diazepam, which probably piques some interest in the listening audience there because that's an interesting description. And also grounding VR, a transition space. So I think we've mostly focused on the anchoring VR. How do these other VR scenarios play into the psychotherapeutic process?
I could mention that. So when I was describing the scenarios earlier and how we use them, grounding VR is the scenario that we use as that meditative resting space that we use in every session to settle someone into the experience. Grounding VR, sorry, Surrender VR is that all, you know, immersive scenario that we use for that transition zone into the psychedelic therapy experience. That's to buffer the internal dialogue. It's a sort of a journey-based scenario that leads someone in, almost holding their hand from an ordinary state of consciousness into an altered state of consciousness. And then there's Anchoring VR. Rescue VR, our digital diazepam, that's probably what we would talk least about at the moment. For now, that remains our secret sauce. I think we're a little while away from being ready to talk about it that openly. But okay. It's promising and very interesting.
Okay, so just if I've got this clear here. So then that the grounding VR, that sounds like that's used maybe in the initial stages of the process and then also potentially at the very end. The surrender is, it sounds like that's more for the come on of the psychedelic itself to kind of ease you into those more altered states.
Correct. And the anchoring VR is the heaviest model. And that's what we use in intention setting. And we use at the tail end of the experience to record the insights. And it's what we continue to use in every integration session to build up this mind map, this memory library.
Yeah. So that's the one that the patient is really continually augmenting and interacting with and kind of creating their whole therapeutic process within that VR.
Spot on. Yes.
So in terms of the actual development of the imagery that's being used, how are you guys going about that process? And like if someone's an artist and they want to be involved in something like this, like what are you guys looking for in terms of creating the actual experience within the VR?
I'll jump in very quickly and say if someone's an artist and keen to be involved in this, please write to us. We'd love to work with you. That's the very, very short answer to begin with. In terms of how we actually design the visuals, I mean, that's principally Agnieszka's domain. Very briefly, we try to keep the visuals not overly stimulating. We try to keep them relatively neutral in terms of cultural, you know, social-cultural perspectives, because we want this to be as applicable as possible. Just to give you one example, our anchoring scenario is set on a beach, which is a gorgeous Australian beach, which Australia is perfect for. That's what it's modeled on. And we use that because a beach is, if you really think in terms of, you know, archetypally, a beach is a kind of space where you go to sit and think and to ruminate and to collect your thoughts. It's an ideal process for that sort of contemplation, or place for that sort of contemplation. And yet, you still have the capacity to create a really beautiful scene, which can be incredibly realistic without being overly stimulating, which is exactly what we're trying to avoid. So that's perhaps an example of the thought process of how we went about sort of picking that scenario.
Yeah, I like that description of sort of being comforting and inviting, but not overly stimulating. And I also really appreciate that you mentioned not including a lot of specific cultural references within the VR experience itself. That I mean, since this is such a new area that I'd never really considered that before, but a question that people ask me very often, because, you know, I help consult people on their psychedelic experiences, that people ask me about music and what kind of music might be best in a certain psychedelic environment. And one of the things that I always like to recommend to people is to not be using music that has specific cultural or religious or spiritual references within it, because it might preload your experience in a particular way. And so that's having something that's a bit more neutral, I personally find to be more efficacious for people to kind of explore their own symbology and their own archetypal references that might arise within their experience, rather than, you know, loading it with specific cultural or traditional imagery.
Which is incredibly hard. It is very, very hard to avoid that. I think particularly with music, it's very, very hard to avoid that. And to, you know, credit to the way therapy is conducted now, I think there is always, it's an approximation to the perfect model. When no one's, I think anyone who imagines that they've got the perfect soundtrack or the perfect setting for it is kidding themselves. We can only do the best that we possibly can and accept that it's only ever going to be an approximation to the optimal point. But it's not always necessarily going to work for everyone. And there's always that balance between sensitivity and specificity, as they talk about in statistics, between creating, offering something that is broad enough as to be palatable and acceptable for the greatest number of people, and creating something that is going to be absolutely on point for a small number of people. And finding that balance is always going to be a tango.
Absolutely. In terms of the immersive environments, and you were describing that it can be very realistic, and I suppose it can also be kind of surreal, just again, looking at the video that's on the website. So maybe we could turn to Agnieszka in terms of how the aesthetics are developed. Like, what are you taking into consideration in developing these virtual environments? And especially knowing that a lot of people in, maybe not necessarily in the psychedelic psychotherapeutic space, but a lot of people just in the psychedelic culture in general, many of them are like, oh, I only want to do it in nature. I don't want to be in a doctor's office. You know, so how is the VR application sort of satisfying that need, but still it's a digital environment, or are you also looking to present something that's entirely different that you couldn't get from a natural environment?
Yeah, so the short answer is that none of this came from just sort of our idealistic thoughts about what a psychedelic experience should look like or where it should be placed. It has taken me about maybe 2 years of research before I've sort of created the very first shape within the VR. This is all based, again, on what both the therapists and the sort of people who have had experiences with psychedelics believe to be the best place for them to be conducive of a mystical experience and of being able to reconnect with that experience, what kind of reminders they normally use in order to be able to reconnect with what their psychedelic experience was like. So it was basically gathering a lot of information and a lot of data on what would be most suitable for people objectively, rather than just thinking about our own subjective kind of, ideal places for ourselves. And so the result kind of led us to that that concept of having, in a way, having both of what you mentioned, having a beautiful, immersive, natural landscape that is as realistic as possible. And I think everyone who's seen our beach really thinks that it does trick you into thinking that you're on an actual beach. From, the being able to see the grains of the sand and hearing the waves of the ocean and seeing how the water is moving, it is incredibly realistic. But then on top of that, you've got those elements that you're interacting with, which are completely abstract. So you're combining this world that looks a little bit familiar in a way that is very serene and soothing, and there are other aspects why we chose the beach as well. It's not just because most people told us that this would be the most sort of soothing and best place for introspection, but also because there's a sense of vastness that the ocean brings. It does make you feel like you're more connected with nature, like there's something really, really big out there. The ocean has a lot of power, and it does show up for a lot of people as something that is powerful and soothing and connecting in their trips. So that's one of the reasons why we've chosen the beach as well. But then there's this contrast with those very abstract, surreal elements that you can interact with. In our case, these are those beautiful crystals and stars that are being created in front of you that you can play with. And there's something about that contrast between things that are completely abstract and surreal and you would never encounter in the real world, But being placed within that soothing environment that has this capacity to kind of trick our senses a little bit into thinking that this is real. This is real, but this is something that is completely unexpected and completely novel, and therefore very engaging and immersive. So that's one of the sort of the interplay of the familiar and the natural, or the beauty of the natural world, in contrast with this very abstract and novel elements that we are providing.
So then, in terms of the progression of the dosing session itself, I think we've already mentioned it, but maybe if we could just walk through again about how these different elements would be used specifically within the dosing session and the different phases that have been identified there.
So it also depends on what kind of substance are we talking about, because obviously every substance works differently, and the models could be utilized differently for every substance. So at the moment, we are collaborating with ketamine clinics, so maybe I can focus on ketamine a little bit more.
Sure.
So the anchoring model would be used in preparation session to create the intention for the upcoming session. Patients would record their intentions for themselves in little crystals that are created in the beach environment. And they would take those crystals with them into the dosing session. So the way it looks is that at the very beginning of the ketamine session, they would put the headset on, they would sit on the beach, and whenever they would be ready to dive deeper into their intention, they would grab for their crystal and listen to that sort of pre-recorded intention that they've created for themselves in order to focus on that intention. So ketamine can be a little bit, it can be a little bit difficult for people to be able to focus on something that they wanted to focus on as they go into that trip. It can feel very, you know, beautiful and soothing and floaty, but we are trying to maximize the time of the dosing session. And so we'd like people to be able to be guided a little bit into diving into those specific intentions and using that time during the dosing session to unpack some of the things that are very difficult to unpack otherwise. And so the purpose of using those crystals with those pre-recorded intentions, that are pre-recorded in their own voice, is to maintain that focus, diving into the ketamine session on that intention, and try to direct them to be able to maintain that focus throughout the ketamine session. And they can stay within the VR environment for the entire dosing session if they want to. With ketamine, it's usually around an hour or a little bit longer. And then the beach is just there to be a beautiful container for them. It's a sort of VR has a capacity to buffer everything that is within their environment. So the hospital setting or the nurse sitting there. Like when you're within VR, it makes you forget that all of this is happening, and basically you're spending your entire ketamine session in a beautiful beach, which is much more conducive of having that mystical experience and of being able to sort of dive deep into yourself and achieve a deeper state of mindfulness. And so initially the intentions are there to remind you to stay focused on that. But then as sort of your insights come up, or there's any sort of emotional impact that is sort of profoundly felt as a result of the ketamine session, you can create new stars for yourself to record those insights that emerge. So you're slowly building your model as you go through the ketamine session by adding star after star after star, each star being loaded with that insights or emotion that are recorded in your own voice. And at the end of the ketamine session, you're basically ending up with a collection or a constellation of those stars that you've recorded for yourself. And the ketamine session ends with a sunset on the beach, and the stars that you've recorded for yourself are being saved for you And you'll be revisiting those stars during the integration session to, again, as we already spoke to you about, to begin that integration process and begin to dive deeper into them and explore them and build that mind map.
Great. So I wonder if you could expand on that a little bit then when we get into something like psilocybin, which is classically far more visually stimulating and productive than something like ketamine. That was one of the questions that kind of popped into my mind when the proposal for this interview first came up about VR with psychedelic therapy. And I was thinking, wow, well, wonder how that goes with the highly visual states, you know, because often in the therapeutic setting, it's promoted to use an eye mask so that you're really focusing on your inner vision. And so I'm just curious how you guys see this functioning in those more visionary kind of environments, or is that a time to close your eyes within the VR headset? Do you take the VR headset off, or what is it that is being recommended here for that kind of usage?
Yeah, so we definitely do not use VR during the peak phase of the experience with psilocybin. So the model is slightly similar in a way that I spoke about in terms of the intention setting, but with psilocybin, we only use it at the very beginning of the dosing session. So immediately after dosing for about 15, 20 minutes, the patient can revisit their intentions. It helps them to sort of have that sense of surrender and letting go, as Prash mentioned, and use those intentions to listen to them, to try to focus on them and be sort of reminded of what the focus of their trip should be, at least initially. And so whenever they're ready, at around 15, maybe 20 minutes post taking the substance, they will take off the VR headset, and the headset will be replaced with blindfolds. So the idea is to sort of capture that time when the effects sort of start to come up, but mm-hmm. they're not fully expressed yet. And there's a little bit of that sort of waiting game of, oh, is it happening? Is it happening? Is it happening? Which can be stressful, and patients might try to distract themselves a little bit from that. And because it's stressful, it makes it much more difficult to try and focus on your intention, which is what we all try to encourage patients to do. But obviously, if you have a little bit of that anxiety and things are sort of happening but not fully yet, then it's almost impossible to expect of someone to stay grounded enough to be able to remember what the intention was. And so what we're trying to do with VR is to try to make them forget that those effects are coming up, to provide that immersive model where they can literally just surrender to, and all they have to sort of worry about is that intention that is in front of them. So they listen to those intentions, and hopefully by the time they take off the headset, the effect will already be sort of there. So we're sort of designing it in a way that we're putting the headset on before any effects are felt. And then when we replace the headset with blindfolds, they should be already sort of falling into that experience. And for the entire peak phase, the experience is left uninterrupted. It's in the same way as any of the current protocols are sort of focusing on using predominantly the blindfolds. Most of them will be using music and limiting the interaction with the therapist, and the role of the therapist being predominantly to hold the space for someone. And that's exactly the same way we are approaching this. So we're not using VR up until the very, very tail end of the experience, which with psilocybin tends to be between 4.5 and 5 hours post-dosing, depending on the patient. And we actually wait for the patient to initiate the first contact and to show that they are sort of emerging back. So they would normally start saying something usually like, wow, or, yeah. you know, oh my God, that was amazing. Wow is the most common phrase used.
Yes.
So whenever the patient starts to sort of show the signs of returning, that's when we replace the blindfolds with the headset again. So the first thing that they see after taking off the blindfolds is that beach. And that's important to us, to have VR as this transition zone so they can be immersed in that environment before they are kind of forced in a way to face the external reality. So it's that sort of that in-between world that we are providing them with, so they can begin expressing themselves within that world before they face the external reality. Because we do know that the moment we start to, like, we open our eyes, we start to speak to people, we start to sort of interact with that familiar world, we start to forget very quickly what has actually happened. It starts to sort of disconnect us from that mystical space that we've entered. So we want to capture those insights before they face that external reality.
Mm-hmm.
There's something broke off, I think. I was just going to add that. And then by the time they take off the headset, which is usually 40, 45 minutes after they've put it on, the effects are probably going to be fully gone. And they'll be ready to sort of start a sort of process of communicating with the therapist and then, you know, coming back to that reality.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it's a very interesting application in the sense that they get a space where it's sort of outside of the psychedelic experience at that point, but it's still private for them and they can be in there for as long as they want before making that engagement with the outside world. And then also doing their own symbolic recording within that space. And as you, the language you guys are using of anchoring these different points in their mind map and really providing them with an interesting space to interact with themselves within the therapeutic space. So I've kept you guys on for a while now, and so I do feel we should be wrapping it up fairly soon here and let you guys get about your day. But I do want to ask you just kind of from the practical side of things. So we have ketamine clinics are now pretty much all along the West Coast of the United States at this point, in California, Oregon, I believe in Washington as well. As I mentioned, we have psilocybin-assisted therapy starting here in Oregon in 2023, so it's potentially coming within the next few months. So there's already a lot of people who are making preparations and plans, and there are clinics that are looking to be opening. If they wanted to use this technology and integrate this into their own work, are you guys at the stage where that's something that people here in Oregon, they could start using these products? Or is this something that's it's coming down the line? Where exactly are we in terms of the actual distribution of and application of the products?
Yeah, I can speak to this. I think we're ready to work with any clinics. We're starting to onboard our first clinics in Europe in the next month, and then we're heading to the United States at the end of October and November and starting to onboard our first clinics in the United States. We're very open and keen to work with anyone who's setting up. I think it's worth mentioning that particularly with ketamine clinics, although not exclusively, there's sort of two clear models. There's ketamine therapy, which is very focused on the pharmacotherapy, the pharmacological effect of the ketamine. And then there's ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, which is got a greater psychotherapy focus, but it's quite resource-intensive and very therapist-time-intensive, even though it does produce like really good sustainable outcomes. And in effect, what we're proposing as a VR-modulated ketamine-assisted psychotherapy is something that sits somewhere as almost as a third protocol, a third means of using ketamine, which adds to the scalability of ketamine therapy. That is a major issue with ketamine-assisted psychotherapy because of the resource issue, but it's far more optimal because of the psychotherapy component that it brings in than standard ketamine pharmacotherapy. And we would definitely like to put this forward as an option for clinics that are just starting to get themselves started as a completely alternative protocol to consider. We are going to be in the United States from about mid to late October, and we'll be moving around, and we'd be very game to talking to anyone who's interested.
Fantastic. So for anybody out there who's listening, who's saying, yeah, I'm setting up a clinic and this is something I'm interested in, what's the best way for them to reach out to you guys and make contact?
I'd say off our website. I mean, both our emails are listed on our website. Or hit us up on LinkedIn, either the company, Enosis Therapeutics, or either of us. Prash or Agnieszka, and just send us a message or an email. We're always very happy to chat.
Great. Well, thank you both very much for your time today and exploring this very interesting realm of VR and psychedelic psychotherapy. Just to kind of bring it back around to where we started today, I think it's fascinating that we're having this conversation today, and it's really reflective of how far the movement towards psychedelic psychotherapy has really come over the past couple decades. Because, 15 years ago, never would have had a conversation like this when I first started this podcast, but we're at a place where people like yourselves are developing these new approaches and these new technologies and applying them to this area. And I just think it's fascinating. I'm always curious about innovations and change. And it's exciting to see this use of technology in a way that sounds very promising and very interesting.
Thank you, Martin. And thank you for sort of encapsulating our approach so cleanly. If you ever want to work as a copywriter, you're on.
Right on. All right. Well, you guys have a great day. Thank you so much for your time.
Cheerio. Bye-bye.
Bye.